Well, how old they think Mick Jagger is?
54, 49, so about 53 actually.
50.
Well, the thing is, we're not this body but spirit soul, so material age is irrelevant.
I'll tell you exactly how old he is. He'll be either 51 or 52 in July. 45?
I think more 55.
I think 52 this July.
He's actually 50.
Really?
He looks older, probably.
What a drag it is getting old.
Michael Philip Jagger is 50 years old today. The man who is to pop music what Rudolph Valentino was to the silent cinema is half a hundred and already a grandfather. I'm Philip Norman. I know Jagger's story because I wrote the biography of the Rolling Stones. It's a story of contrasts, of rebellion and conventionality, of recklessness and caution, of a social outcast who became a social climber. It's a story of drugs, beautiful women, and cricket. It's a story of extraordinary endurance. Above all, it's the story of an image.
Hey! Without his sexuality, Jagger would be nothing.
Mick was quite fetching with his onstage singing and mannerisms.
I didn't like them, I have to say.
I liked him. I think he quite liked me. We got on very well together.
Jaggerism stood for a reaction in favour of individualism.
There was a sense of putting two fingers up to the world.
The Rolling Stones, the Rolling Stones, the greatest rock and roll band in the world, the Rolling Stones.
As a boy, he was quite sporty and very clean living. His father was a physical training instructor.
I used to listen to Dan Dare a lot on Radio Luxembourg. You know, he gets a lot of trouble about it.
Mm. Mick was brought up to enjoy sport and the outdoor life and to have no idea of decadent existence.
Marching bands, you know, anything with a beat. That's about all they had with a beat on the radio in those days. The RAF March Past, that was one of my favourites. I can't remember how it goes now.
He was always, according to his mother, rather a theatrical boy who liked dressing up and miming to music on the radio.
Well, I was brought up in an extremely bourgeois home by extremely bourgeois parents. So I had a very straight upbringing, really. I went to a local school and I passed 11th class and I went to grammar school. And I started singing when I was about 16. Or before that, really. But not very seriously, just for a laugh.
The real turning point for him was hearing blues music. He used to sing with a group called Little Boy Blue and the Blue Boys. The very name tells you they didn't expect to get anywhere, and they never did. They didn't perform at all except to the mother of one of the Blue Boys, who always indeed said that Mick was going to go places, but they never went any further than that.
Went to the fortune teller,
and my fortune read. And I went to university. London School of Economics, and I stayed there for 2 years. It was really boring, so I thought, well, I'll leave, you know, because we had a record in the charts then, and they were very nice to me, so they said I could come back.
I want you back again. I want your love again.
They really got started when he met up with Keith Richards, whom he had known at primary school, and they started to play together. They were sort of Marxists. They thought money was selling out. They wanted to be blues men. They wanted to be poor. The crucial ingredient here was Brian Jones. Brian Jones wanted to be a star.
Hello, this is Long John Baldry, forgotten blues veteran of this parish. I think round about March the 12th, 1962, it was either Lions or ABC Tea Rooms in Ealing Broadway.
It was under a tea shop in Ealing, an ABC tea shop.
And it was a basement premises that Alex Corner was renting out every Thursday night for the Ealing Rhythm and Blues Club. And
there was a blues club playing real blues music by real blues bands.
I was one of the founder members of Blues Incorporated, the band with Cyril Davis and Alex's Corner. I got to meet Mick and Keith. Brian Jones was there also. They asked if they could get up and sing, perform, do whatever. And Alex was always a very kind guy. And he said, yeah, sure. And they got up and jammed.
They thought they were the only blues band in the Western Hemisphere. Suddenly they realized they were part of this underground, that other people love this American uncommercial black music. So that was how Jagger first got up in front of an audience and sang the blues.
You can make it if you try.
It was just wet. Cyril Davis had to put a horrible sheet, revoltingly dirty, over the bandstand. It was very dangerous too, you see, because all the electricity and all the microphones and those things. But I never got a shot. I remember scenes with John Baldry and Paul Jones.
Yeah.
Older than me, much spottier even. I couldn't ever sort of get in key, you know what I mean? It's just such a problem, because I was quite often very drunk, because I was... The first time I was really nervous. I'd never sung in public before.
I thought he was both of them, you know, very charming guys. They were totally in love with the blues.
So Mick Jagger, Brian Jones, and then Keith Richard formed the nucleus of what then became the Stones.
Mick was quite fetching with his onstage singing and mannerisms. I mean, I guess if he had been truly awful on that first night asking to come up, Alex wouldn't have allowed it again.
Well, I'm a king bee, buzzing around your house.
The establishment was very quick to embrace them. I had a girlfriend called Bunty Lampson, whose father was Lord Killearn. He was the former ambassador to Egypt. And she was a debutante in 1963, and her coming out dance, which was in the caves in Hastings, had, as the cabaret, the Rolling Stones. I remember she told me with some sort of fury that she'd got the band for the night and that they'd charged her £20.
My first encounter with Mick Jagger must have been during the course of Saturday Club. I couldn't possibly put a date on it. I didn't like them, I have to say. I've got a much greater admiration for particularly Mick Jagger and for the Stones in general and the sort of thing they've done in recent years than I ever have for anything they did in the past. In fact, I do recall being singularly unimpressed. I thought they were a very ragged sort of band.
The Beatles were cuddly, acceptable, seemed to be nice lads, friendly, polite to interviewers and the press, that sort of thing. So the Stones were going to be surly and wicked and dirty. Now, this is ridiculous because the Beatles were quite surly and dirty and had a fairly sort of checkered career in the Hamburg clubs before they became famous. The Rolling Stones were really well brought up, nice suburban lads. So for them to be the outlaws and the Beatles to be the cuddly mop tops was just a complete sort of inversion. In those days, all groups wore suits. Stones didn't wear suits. They didn't have haircuts. They didn't cut their hair around their ears. And they would turn up at the Savoy without a tie. That was the way you became an outcast in 1963. Their first single was just a cover version of a Chuck Berry song, Come On. Mick Jagger, although having this reputation as tremendously daring and reckless, is actually cautious. Even the lyrics of Come On, he watered down. He didn't want to sing the word jerk, as Chuck Berry sings it. He sang the word fool, or guy.
Emergence of the Beatles and the Stones was indicative of a radical change of attitude on the part of young people at the time. We were a society in stable condition, rather grey, rather dull, everybody dressed in the same sorts of way.
They were being photographed on a traffic bollard in the Brompton Road just opposite Harrods. And they stopped the traffic because, for the first time, the denizens of Knightsbridge in their pinstripe suits and their bowler hats saw danger, they saw animals, they saw aliens. The establishment don't like their daughters being molested by heathens and yobs, and the establishment realised that the pop world were going to introduce their children to things like drugs. And they were a definite threat. They were dangerous, bad and mad, and they knew that there was a new dawn here socially.
The youth of the late 50s had no very strong culture of their own. We drew our culture out of America, and what happened was a root and branch questioning of attitudes and values of all kinds.
It was, I suppose, an outbreak of individuality and individualism.
Seeing them in those early days, you would have thought this is a band that is going to get nowhere. They're just doing cover versions of American blues and rhythm and blues songs, and what is going to happen when they've got no more cover versions to do? They were stumped for what to follow up Come On With, and they met the Beatles in Soho and got a still unfinished song, I Want to Be Your Man.
To Richmond, we had like a lot of boys and girls, like pretty equal. Yeah, but, I mean, a lot of boys.
Yeah.
After that, then it was all girls.
Yeah.
Then it was girls and boys. You know, but in America, it's always been in the big cities, girls and boys. You know, mm-hmm. And in the smaller places, girls. You know, mm-hmm. And in Hawaii, which we just played, there's a lot of girls. You know, like really young. You know, like 12, which is very nice for me. You know, because I don't want to play to housewives. You know. At the beginning, we used to do ballrooms and clubs, and it would be dead as a dodo in Aberystwyth. And in some places, you get jumped on and you can hardly play.
Can you tell me what you thought of the concert you just been to?
It was fantastic! It was beautiful.
Well, living on the road, basically living on the road, you know. I mean, living on the road the same as I was years ago.
Have you ever been to the Rolling Stones before?
Never.
No, this is
I've
first
listened
time.
To the music, and I love them, and they're beautiful.
Now, if you want to hear some boogie like I'm going to play, there's just an old piano and a knife out of bass. The drummer man's a cat, they call Charlie my boy. You know, remember that rubber leg boy. Mama cooking chicken fried and bacon grease.
With a bit more money, we don't end up in a box, you know, at night with just a band and a bunch of roadies and throwing bottles out the window.
How many years have you been listening to that music now?
7 or 8, 9, some.
I mean, really, the change in lifestyle is not startling.
They were just very super professional, you know. What is this, anyway?
It's for the BBC in London.
Oh, really? Excellent.
Like on the wrong side.
Delightful.
Far out.
What Andrew Oldham, as their manager, was clever enough to realise was that they were not going to get anywhere unless they wrote their own material in the way that John Lennon and Paul McCartney wrote their own songs. That was the way you kept it going. And he ordered Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, who'd become Keith Richard by that point, he said, you've got to write songs. And he locked them in the kitchen of the flat they all shared in Willesden and said, you're not coming out until you've written a song. And that was how they started to write.
The things we wrote to start off with were more like ballads, or they were like pop songs, which came more naturally to us rather than writing the original blues, which is very difficult to write, actually.
Well, I've told you once and I've told you twice, but you never listen
to my advice. Tell me, the last time, have you got any follow-up to this one?
No, we haven't recorded one yet, no.
Do you know if you would write it yourself or anything?
I hope we write it ourselves. I should make more money that way.
In writing, Jagger, has played a monumental part that perhaps isn't sort of well recognised. He is a marvellous songwriter and a marvellous innovative lyricist.
we work independently and we work together. You know, we're not always together, keep in mind. We don't live, sleep, and eat together. So obviously we have ideas of our own. But we always play into each other and we know what we're doing. I quite often write extra words to what Keith's done. And he quite often changes things around that I've done.
But it would not have worked had not Jagger had this very good sort of little literary streak in him. He was a good student at school and he was good at English and writing essays. And he could really write a marvellous lyric.
I think Keith's a really talented songwriter. I think he's very underestimated as a songwriter. But I think Keith's much more able to stand on his own than either Lennon or McCartney.
Of rock and roll are entirely sex standing up.
Everybody assumed that Satisfaction meant sexual satisfaction. It wasn't that at all. It was actually a blues song in the pop idiom. The blues musicians in America sang about not having enough. Spoiled white boys in Britain sang about having too much. It was a blues song about being pampered and being bored.
The first time I heard it was in, Keith was playing around with a riff. He didn't really like it, he thought it was a joke. And he didn't think it was a single or anything. And that's the only real disagreement we've ever had, you know what I mean? Like, we said,
"You're off your head."
You know, which he was, of course. A song is a song. The words go with the music, and the music goes with the words.
In 1967, Jagger was jailed for 3 months for possessing drugs. He was led from the court crying. The next day, an unopposed application for bail pending appeal was granted. In The Times, editor William, now Lord Rees-Mogg, spoke out against the convictions.
There are cases in which a single figure becomes the focus for public concern about some aspects of public morality. If we're going to make any case a symbol of the conflict between the sound traditional values of Britain and the new hedonism, then we must be sure that the sound traditional values include those of tolerance and equity.
Mick Jagger and Keith Richard were subjected to a disgraceful show trial.
It should be the particular quality of British justice to ensure that Mr. Jagger is treated exactly the same as anyone else. No better and no worse.
Jagger received a prison sentence for supposedly possessing these very innocuous travel tablets.
There must remain a suspicion in this case that Mr. Jagger received a more severe sentence than would have been thought proper for any purely anonymous young man.
By the middle 60s, he seemed to be the devil incarnate. He was only a singer with a band, for goodness sake. But the whole drug culture, the way that the young seemed to have a license to do anything that they wanted to do, created this huge backlash of fear and resentment. And in that so-called Summer of Love, 1967, there was an extremely ugly determination on the part of the establishment to get the Rolling Stones and to get Mick Jagger.
Suddenly, this other generation seemed to be putting its foot down, and that was the symbolism of the Jagger affair. One of the things that was very interesting is that the establishment broke ranks, and somebody like Reese Mogg, writing eloquently in the Times, seemed to understand that this youth movement was not threatening, it wasn't revolutionary, it was evolutionary.
Something happened to me yesterday. Something I can't speak of right away. Something happened to me. Something also groovy.
He was like somebody in the Middle Ages being baited with the rabble's curse. He was taken from the court handcuffed.
He don't know if it's right or wrong. Maybe he should tell someone. He's not sure just what it was, or if it's against the law. Something.
It was very, very, I mean, they were really nasty and mean. They just were mean. They weren't handcuffed, you know, and four pet pill charges. I mean, yeah, it's just daft. I mean, when I think about it, you know, I mean, I hardly ever think about it, but when I do, maybe I'm just, you know, it's just so absurd, you know.
But something really threw me. Something also threw me. Something happened to me yesterday.
I hoped that the leader might shake up the judges a bit. Mick Jagger was innocent of any serious crime. Purely technical offence.
Well, it affected me great because I was sitting in jail when someone threw it through the window, which is illegal in jail. That was what, you know, sort of got me out and helped get us off because it was against normal press conduct.
We were reacting against the hysteria of the time, which wanted to make Mick Jagger a scapegoat for the perceived evils of society.
It was something I'll always remember and be grateful for.
John Burt was a researcher on World in Action. He saw an idea for a program bringing the church and state together, face to face, with Mick Jagger.
We dramatically flew Jagger out by helicopter to this location, and he emerged from the helicopter, his hair blowing in the breeze, a romantic, dashing figure, sat down with members of the so-called British establishment and proceeded to debate what we hoped were the underlying issues of the day. I have to say, the discussion that emerged was not very profound or penetrating, but the symbolism of that event, I think, was very important, and that's why it captured the imagination of people at the time.
One of the great myths about Jagger is that he was steeped up to his eyebrows in drugs. He really wasn't. He was frightened of them.
I don't think that, like, hard drugs are very good for anyone. You don't have to be a musician to know that. You just have to come to America, or you just have to stand in Piccadilly Circus. I just don't think people can handle drugs, period. Most people can't. A lot of people can't handle alcohol. A lot of people can't handle anything. You know, most people are addicted to cigarettes. A lot of people are addicted to hard drugs. They just cannot handle them. They get ill. They rely on them. You know, they fall to pits. You know, I mean, it's horrible.
It's one of the awful ironies of his career that on almost the only occasion that he experimented with drugs, 18 policemen came through the window.
I got the sunshine on a cloudy day.
After he was released by the Court of Appeal, he and I dashed across London in a white Jaguar to Battersea Heliport, where Marianne Faithfull was waiting for him. The three of us got into the back seat of the helicopter. It was a tight fit, and Jagger was a happy man. He wasn't in jail, he was free. Marianne Faithfull was extremely pleased to see him. They immediately locked in a passionate embrace on the back seat of this helicopter. Marianne Faithfull sat next to me and writhed and turned in her passion whilst I sat trying to enjoy the countryside and look out the window as best I could.
A great switch was taking place. We had, from the early 1930s, through the war, the post-war Labour government, assumptions of welfare, we'd had a collectivist emphasis in society, and if you can call something Jaggerism, Jaggerism stood for a reaction in favour of individualism, the right of the individual to lead his or her own life, rejection of community values, and so on. This later was an important part of the appeal of Thatcherism. The reason that the 80s had Mrs. Thatcher and Reagan was that this kind of individualism 10, 15 years later worked through.
When we got to the country home where the interview was to take place, we showed Jagger and Marianne Faithfull to a room so that they could freshen up, and I told them that they had an hour.
It was actually very important. But people are never, to my mind, manipulative leaders of this kind of movement. They happen to become representative leaders because they belong to the age group which feels these things.
I went downstairs and an anxious production team said, "Where is he? Where is he? We have to start straight away." And I said, "Oh, I thought we had another hour." And they said, "Oh, no, the schedule has to be changed. Go upstairs and get him and bring him down." So I am afraid, after my helicopter trip, had a pretty good idea of what was going on upstairs, rightly or wrongly, and gingerly knocked on the door. There was no reply. I waited a decent amount of time, wondering what to do. I thought, well, I plainly have to get him downstairs. So I banged on the door in a very sort of tired and frustrated voice, said, "Yeah." I said, "I'm very sorry, Mick. We have to go downstairs." "Okay.
You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want."
He had in him visibly at that time elements which were really potentially those of a rather conservative personality.
Jagger has dickered with the idea of politics, but ultimately there is too much work involved, there's too much self-sacrifice involved.
One of the big things that most adults have against you is the fact that you seem to have absolutely no morals whatsoever. Is this true?
Yeah. I haven't got their morals, or... and they haven't got mine. I mean, I've got my own. I really believe that most people actually have. I mean, people try and say they follow a moral code. They might say, "I'm a Christian," for instance. And when it comes down to it, they really don't follow the moral Christian code at all, but they merely change it around to suit themselves.
Don't you worry about what's on your mind, woman.
Well, I don't want to blame Mick Jagger for what's been happening in society. But, I mean, if you look back now at the price that society as a whole and countless people have paid for what is generally called the permissive society, I have a right to do what I want because I want to. That was the philosophy of the permissive society. And the price paid for that in human suffering of all kinds has been incalculable.
Your latest song, you've been quoted as saying that this doesn't mean that whoever is singing this song is suggesting that they go to bed together. In fact, do you care whether people think that or not?
No, I don't really mind what they think about it. It's very simple to me. I mean, I don't really mind if they go to bed together either. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, the people in America who banned the record, are the sort of people that sitting in San Francisco eating their steaks served by topless waitresses, you know. And they're the kind of people that are banning it, and I think that's fantastic. I mean, all it does is just show their complete hypocrisy, which is very amusing to watch.
I think he was a symbol of a strain of thought in the youth movement at the time.
Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste.
We're not trying to create our own, but unfortunately, you can't but help create your own establishment, and that's what we're doing. We're creating our own conformity, which is a much looser conformity than the one before, but it's certainly got its rules.
In the Stones, there was a sense of putting two fingers up to the world.
How do you think you've changed, looking at yourself?
I don't know, I talk about how I've changed, because it's impossible for me to analyse it, because I'm in the middle of it, you know. One can never analyse an artichoke from the inside. Where was I? Nowhere. Carry on.
Well, you were trying to change the world.
Yes, I am. Well, we've all got to try and change the world, you know, because it's only us, you know, that we can do it, you know. But then it's a very slow job, but we can make that contribution. Did we change anything? Answer, I don't know. Have things changed? Yes, obviously.
Yesterday don't matter if it's gone. While the sun is bright, or in the darkest night, no one knows. She comes and goes. Why she needs to be so free. She'll tell you it's the only way to be. She just can't be chained to a life where nothing's gained and nothing's lost. At such a cost.
I'm Nigel Dempster, the editor of the Daily Mail Diary and the Mail and Sunday Diary, and I was born almost the same year as Mick and sort of grew up with the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, and it's a joy to realise that we've all managed to get here into the second half of our century. Mick was always sort of brighter than most pop stars. For instance, he has always been able to understand about art and architecture, and he knows about good wines.
Now I go walking in his silk suit and makeup on and order a sort of Bloody Mary and some cocktail bar, and he'll say, oh, I ain't serving you, yeah? In some places, people are really rude to him, bars and stuff, restaurants, they don't want to know, you know.
He was a cut above the other pop stars who have vanished because he understood he could be welcomed into stately homes, and he could go to Blenheim Palace and recognise a Gainsborough from a Reynolds. If you were going to give a party, if the Duke of Marlborough was to give a party for his children, you'd want stars, superstars, so you would get Mick, because Mick could hold his own at a dinner table. He was good to look at. He didn't eat with his fingers.
If people who you respect, say somebody who knows about music, someone like Henry Mancini or that, who you would never expect to say nice things about you, when he does, which he has, you know, you're very surprised and very pleased.
I'm Mary Whitehouse. I met Mick Jagger in October 1968. And that meeting on the David Frost programme remains for me something that really I quite treasure. We got on terribly well. And what was more, I liked him. I think he quite liked me. We got on very well together.
She smiles sweetly. She smiles sweetly.
They suffered under the very carefully contrived image that was being projected, I suppose, as a result of the work of their publicist come manager, Andrew Lowe Golden, who was very sharp in that respect. If he could get his boys on the front page of a paper, then he wasn't averse to encourage them to be photographed urinating against the wall of a garage.
What about friends? I imagine you have very few friends in your kind of work.
Yeah, there aren't many, because lots of the people who try and be your friends, you know, you don't respect, you don't like, you just think they're trying to be your friends just because of who you are. That's all. So you choose your friends very carefully, and there are very few of them.
He always wanted to be in a higher social sphere, to do things like join the MCC and watch cricket in the sort of VIP box.
That there's any danger of you becoming part of the establishment. Maybe perhaps one day Mick Jagger will be comparing a housewife's choice.
No, there won't be a housewife's choice. When I went to compare it, you know, in that time, it really must have gone by then. It really can't go on forever, surely.
When you first started, you seemed to try to project the image that you were a lot of inarticulate yobbers.
Most of these things aren't really projected. They're made up by journalists or anybody, really. I really don't care whether they think we're a load of yobs or not.
Down at the English press, when the English press came over here, they were the rudest, most crass, drunk, disgraceful bunch I've ever met. And they were supposed to be the nice ones. I just walked out. I mean, they were just awful, rude, personal, insulting. I mean, that's one of the reasons I'm not living in England, you have to deal with those people, my goodness.
You had been the archetypal anti-parental group, and then had come through that and are now taken up by all the establishment. You're embraced by them now.
Are we? Really? That's why we can't play in America or Japan or Australia and all these places, because we're embraced. I don't think so. It might be a change to be embraced by an establishment, but I haven't been and I don't particularly want to be.
Mick has always sort of tried to get away from the roadie image to a different life. He's been going to Mustique, where Princess Margaret's had a house, since 1971. For certainly, to my knowledge, 15, 16 years. And he's always had the ability to see that there is a life outside. He's bought a beautiful chateau in France. I see him in Paris occasionally, and he's always in the best circles and enjoying himself.
You know, I like France. I've always been going there off and on for years, since I was a kid.
Mick Jagger is extremely clever. He's very bookish. He reads enormously, lives in France, speaks very good French, very interested in money and the manipulation of money and in business, and has really been instrumental in sort of securing the broadly based financial prosperity of the Rolling Stones.
Money, I don't really know. I haven't seen my accountant this year, but it's quite a lot.
He isn't a philanthropist.
I don't care about making all that money from records. As long as we've got enough money to carry on, I don't mind.
He has always been cautious with money. They had very bad financial experiences towards the end of the 60s. All of the Rolling Stones were told they owed huge amounts of back income tax. Writer and broadcaster Rosalind Miles is Cosmopolitan magazine's contributing editor. She believes the mythical Mick Jagger could be a character in a steamy novel.
My interest in Jagger began when I was working on The Rights of Man, which is a book about how men become what they are, the making of masculinity, if you like. He is really an extreme example of how a male with almost nothing going for him has managed to make himself Superman. without his sexuality, Jagger would be nothing. He projects this notion of the wild, pan-like character, really, the completely all-licensed male principle that can do what it likes. And that's part of his popularity, because even though it shocks us, in a little part of our hearts, we like to feel that somebody can do it and get away with it.
There was something about him. You could sense that the eyes of all the girls in the audience were upon him, and he was getting young ladies we need.
I think he's a very shrewd businessman. I think he got hold of the idea right at the beginning of his career that sex sells. He really has to project himself in that way because he hasn't got much else. He's actually very short, although most people don't realize that. Even his mother couldn't say he was good-looking. So there's only one thing left, and that's what he's been peddling. Take Philip Larkin's pronouncement that sex began in 1963. Jagger was right there at the beginning of that, and it certainly was an important part of it.
The original sex object in the Rolling Stones was Brian Jones. Brian Jones was the one who brought the danger to their first concerts because he would deliberately tease the audience into violence. Make the girls scream, and he would taunt the boys at the same time as if he was going to steal all their chicks.
Every woman in her heart is looking for a man who knows what to do, a man who is not tentative, who doesn't fumble and futz around and wonder what on earth is going on. Jagger seems to be totally sexually in control, driven by his own drives so that he has no time to worry about any delicacies. That's the attraction. In real life, actually, I think most women couldn't bear a man who didn't take their feelings into account, who never showed any consideration. It's fantasy, it's illusion. He gives us the feeling that we are flirting with this without actually having to engage with it and put up with it.
Jagger is an emotional person. He's famous for bursting into tears in private on almost any pretext. And he has certainly had relationships that he did care very much about. He certainly cared a lot for Marianne Faithfull. He was very good to Marianne Faithfull's son. He's very good with children.
I was the sun way up there. With my love everywhere, I'll be the moon when the sun goes down to let you know I'm still around. That's how strong my love is, baby. That's how strong my love is.
As men get older, men who play around, it starts to look increasingly sad. A randy grandfather is rather a disgusting spectacle. I think that Jagger's actually in danger of getting a bit of a grotesque. He could very easily become one of those crepuscular old lizards. There are some people who are so ugly that they crash the pain barrier, if you like, and become startling and stunning and in a weird way attractive. Jagger's features are so exotic, that outsized mouth, which seems like a fifth limb, it's so active. Wild staring eyes and erotic posturing do make him undeniably attractive.
Absolutely.
The discussion with David Frost was about marriage, you see. Why Mick Jagger wasn't going to marry Marianne Faithfull and what he felt about having children. As I was leaving the television centre, he came running across the hall to me and he said, "Mary, I want you to know that I do agree with a great deal of what you've said." And of course, when you see how his life is settling now, he himself has caught up and worked through many of those earlier ideas, which weren't, in the truest sense of the word, really very fruitful.
He's been married twice. He married, for the first time, Bianca, who was a fashion model from Nicaragua, who seemed to be almost like the image of Narcissus. She was uncannily like Mick Jagger physically. She became appalled by how, as Mick Jagger's wife, she still had to compete for his attention. She ultimately called the Rolling Stones organization the Nazi state.
I think marriage is I wouldn't recommend it. I mean, I don't mean personally, I just don't think it's necessary. I mean, I still feel the same about it, so I just carry on the same and I find that works.
He's quite clearly a man who's still seeking. After all, if you think what he's got an unlimited fortune. He's got one of the world's most beautiful women as his wife. He's got everything that a man is entitled to expect.
He seems not to care at all about adult relationships with women. The relationship with Jerry Hall, which seemed to be very, very settled for a long time, then seemed to be washed up simply for this old rock star reason of wanting to trade the car in for a younger model.
You used to be my party dog, but now you say the party's over.
There's something worrying about his appeal. Undoubtedly, there are elements of violence and sadism, which is really not right. And yet, undoubtedly, that's a part of his appeal.
I'm not a very violent person. I don't, you know, I mean, I
only have beat the state.
I only have the occasional punch up. You know, it's usually with a photographer or something.
Mike, what happened? Was it something that developed quickly?
Well, it seemed to develop over the second half an hour show that we did. They sort of pushed their way to the front, pushing girls out of the way in doing it. I saw some girls with sort of punch and stomach and knees and stomach. Just, you know, it was really violent and horrible. I didn't see anything like it. And they got right up to the front of the stage and started sort of yelling and swearing at us and throwing bottles and things at us and spitting.
But it's often said of pop songs that you can't hear the lyrics anyway. I took this up with Mick Jagger.
How important are the lyrics to you now?
They're very important, you know. I mean, when people say they can't hear them, I sort of laugh at them because I don't really believe it. Because, well, they hear as much as I sort of feel, I guess. I mean, but I never really worry because I always think people can more or less hear the lyrics, even though they say, what was that? I was what?
The Stones and other groups of the time not only wrote their own music, but they wrote their own words and they talked about things which related clearly and directly to the lives of the young at the time.
To me, they were like just a Cockney sort of blues band.
Jerry Marsden.
I didn't realise how they would get on in the music business. And so we did a show in the States with them called the Tammy Awards. And I saw Mick them working and I thought, oops, and easy. The lad's got talent. And it was amazing. He stormed the audience. And from that moment, I thought, yes, Mick is definitely going to be big.
Okay. You're playing a very large gig, you see, outside. You can't really see the band, you can hear them. Then I think they should have some sort of effect indoors when you've got over 10,000 people there. But I think they should be entertained somehow, apart from just the music, because they can't see.
This figure that is the prototype for all rock singers. Everybody who picks up a hand microphone and strikes an attitude in front of a rock band, even today, is just treading the path that Mick Jagger has trodden 20 years ago.
The music is raw sex, really. He simply illustrates it with his bodily gestures.
There is no attitude, there is no twist of the hips or the buttocks, or no shake of the head, there is no twirl of the hand that hasn't been done by Mick Jagger. And you can stand a quarter of a mile away from Mick Jagger and you can see him pout.
I don't want to be rude in any way or denigrate the Beatles, who I like, but I don't think they really ever got off on stage except when they were playing in clubs. We still can groove on stage, you know, we can change the arrangements around and really play, you know, I can really get into singing. But I don't think the Beatles have ever dug that. They never dug it since they left the cavern, as far as I can see. Personally, I love all the sort of theatre of it, you know, dressing up and everything. I mean, that's just my own personal little bag.
Some people have put that down, though, haven't they? They said that sort of then showmanship shouldn't be a part of musical appreciation.
Well, fine, okay, they can just go and see people who don't. I think if you're going to appear, you might as well go behind a curtain if that's what you want to just hear or play records.
Well, Mick has always said that he doesn't see any reason why he can't perform forever. He's got a fantastic body, he's very athletic, he's got the face of a 50-year-old, the body of a 20-year-old. The rest of the group, of course, will be in bath chairs if they're still alive, but Mick will still be jumping Jack Flash.
To ask him if he would still be doing it when he was 30, because it seemed inconceivable that a 30-year-old could be prancing around the stage. Then they started to ask if he would do it when he was 40, because it would be utterly ridiculous for a 40-year-old to be doing it. Now they're asking if he can do it at 50, and of course he can.
If you read Fab magazine in 1964, you all said, oh, well, we'll do this for a couple of years, you know. And that's how we really felt. And then in 1966, I said, well, how can you really do this? I don't know, man.
Well, how much longer do you think we've got
left? Okay.
Yeah, why not?
I don't know.
Mick Jagger has always had a definite image of himself. It is hard to separate the image because the image has been there for so very long. He certainly has real characteristics, but these things tend to get subjugated if you spend 30 years of your life being told that you're wonderful, a god on earth. It's hard to remain anything like a normal personality.
I keep a diary. I said he's lived a terrible life, and I felt him to be quite a tragic figure in those days. Tremendous amount of gifts and a big heart, but somehow seemed to have missed out on what the essence of life is really all about.
I sit and watch as tears go by. My riches can't buy everything. I want to hear the children sing.
He never seems to quite achieve the potential that he has. It's odd that someone so famous in his own right still really wants the shelter of a pop band. You would have thought that he would have branched out in so many different directions. He was going to write his own memoirs and write them himself, and there's every reason to think that he's a very good writer. Somehow he's never done any of it because there is this worm of insecurity and reticence and caution.
A knighthood I'd take. I think less than a knighthood.
I don't want a life peerage, really. I mean, all or nothing.
It became much bigger than the hype. Andrew Oldham could not have imagined that Mick Jagger and Keith Richards as an axis within a rock band would become the ultimate, I mean, the absolute ultimate components of any group of musicians. Nureyev and Dracula on the same stage.
You have to admire anybody who does what he does and gets away with it.
It's the convention in pop, as in the story of Peter Pan, that no one ever grows old. At 50, Jagger is certainly a figure of stunning youthfulness. And like a young man, like himself 30 years ago, he still seems a figure of endless potential and promise. No doubt he'll still be that way when he receives the telegram from the monarch on his 100th birthday. I'm Philip Norman. The program was produced by Trevor Aston.